program is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio and online at kpfa.org. Co-producer Sasha Lilly is at the controls. My name is C.S. Song. We have a link to Elizabeth Kolbert's new book, Field Notes from a Catastrophe, on our website, againstthegrain.org. Also there, you will find a link to certain greenhouse gas emissions calculators collected on a EPA website. And those are different calculators where you can enter your activities and the activities of, I guess, others and businesses and this kind of thing to see how much greenhouse gas emissions are being generated by various activities. Elizabeth Kolbert joins us by phone from Massachusetts, where she lives. She is also author of The Prophet of Love and Other Tales of Power and Deceit. A lot of people, Elizabeth, might think that sea level rise caused by global warming is due solely to the fact of, or primarily because, glaciers melting and that water being released into the ocean. Is that the reason? Is that the primary reason?
Well, there's two factors in sea level rise. One is called thermal expansion. It's referred to as thermal expansion, and then it sort of is what it sounds like, which is just that water, when you heat it up, expands. It just takes up more volume. So the oceans are warming, that's indisputable, and their volume is expanding. And when you hear sea level projections for the next century or so, they are usually just based on thermal expansion, because there is a lot of sort of question marks hanging over how much something like Greenland or the West Antarctic ice sheet or land-based glaciers are going to contribute over the next century. And one of the interesting things that is happening, there's going to be a new report coming out from what's called the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change next year, 2007. And one of the really interesting questions, now that we are seeing all this, and I have to say the word is alarming, data from both Greenland and Antarctica, is how much that is going to be reflected in this new report in terms of increasing the sea level rise predictions for the next century. Because once you start getting loss of ice from Greenland or Antarctica, you can get very, very monumental sea level rises.
What might be a conservative prediction for a global sea level rise in the next century?
Well, in the current IPCC report, which represents sort of the always a conservative report because it's a huge consensus among gazillion scientists and governments and things like that. So, okay, so the consensus opinion as of 2001, so this is very dated by now, 5 years ago, was somewhere between roughly a foot and 3 feet, 3 feet at the sort of upper limit.
By 2100?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, those are serious. Those are really serious. If you live by the coast, those are serious, serious numbers, even at the lower end. Now, I think there are a lot of people now saying, look, what we're seeing from Greenland and Antarctica, you've got to raise that. You've certainly got to raise the potential at the upper limit. So I don't know what that number is going to be. I think it's going to be much debated, and it's going to scare people.
Let me ask you about China. And a lot of attention is focused on China and what it will do in the near and not-so-near future with regard to energy production and how much fossil fuel burning that will require. How does China currently compare with the U.S. as an emitter of greenhouse gases? And what is the projection as far as when or whether China will overtake the U.S.?
China is still pretty far behind the U.S. right now in terms of its emissions, but it is rapidly. The U.S., I should just point out to give people a sense of what we're talking about, the U.S. emits roughly a quarter of the world's CO2. Okay, so we have less than 5% of the population, and we are emitting a quarter of the CO2. So we are a huge, part of this problem, to be honest, and there's no solution available without our participation. And the Chinese are gaining on us, though. They are building new coal-fired power plants, which are just an immense source of CO2 at the rate of, a few a month, okay? So it's huge. And it's estimated that the Chinese will overtake the Americans in about 20 years, okay? So not that long from now. And I think most people would once again agree you can't solve this problem without the U.S., and you can't solve it without China. It's just not possible without both countries participating in the solution.
And to what extent does China plan to rely on energy production that is heavy on the fossil fuel consumption side?
Oh, very, very largely. And I think that the point is that people would make is that we, the U.S., the rest of the sort of already industrialized world, has to try to intervene to make it more attractive financially through technology transfers for the Chinese to take a different path. To be honest, a different path than the one we took. But right now, if you look at the plans that are just on the drawing board, and the Chinese are very fond of drawing up, you know, 5-year plans, 10-year plans, whatever, it is very heavily weighted towards coal-fired conventional power plants, which are very, very polluting in terms of CO2, and also, I should add, in terms of, you know, just regular, you know, asthma, lung cancer producing pollutants, which you, especially in California, you know, are seeing in your air right now.
Yeah, I'm just reading from your book, Field Notes from a Catastrophe. China's plans indicate that by 2010, the country is expected to build 150 new 1,000-megawatt coal plants, or their generating equivalent. By 2020, it is expected to construct another 168 new plants. And when we talk about, you know, U.S. and U.S. policy, I think most of our listeners know that George W. Bush has rejected the Kyoto Protocol, which mandated reductions in greenhouse gas emissions, and there's, of course, a lot of outrage about that and indignation. But a lot of people might not know the policy that George W. did push. He pushed an approach, I think he announced it in 2002, based on something called greenhouse gas intensity. What is that?
Right. Well, that is a fancy way of saying how much economic output do you get per, you know, unit of CO2 that you emit. So let's say 1 year you produce, 100 widgets and you produce 100 pounds of CO2, and the next year you produce 101 widgets and 100 pounds of CO2, your energy intensity has gone down, but your emissions have stayed the same. So what the Bush administration has been pushing, and I should add that in the normal course of events, energy intensity or greenhouse gas intensity goes down because people figure out how to be more energy efficient, and that is well established and is happening all the time. And so really what people have argued, and I think there's a very strong case to be made, is that the Bush administration policy amounts to doing nothing, to saying, you know, we're always improving our greenhouse gas intensity, and we will just continue to do that. But the problem is, as long as your economy is growing faster than your energy intensity improvements, your emissions are still growing. And what we need to be doing is cutting our emissions.
You talked to White House officials about the current Bush policy on greenhouse gases. What did they tell you about how seriously they take the issue of climate change?
Well, talking to Bush administration officials about global warming, you know, is definitely worthy of, Lewis Carroll. It is really a trip through the looking glass. They will tell you that they take the issue very seriously. That's basically a quote, and you'll hear that over and over again, and I believe the president just said it recently. We take it very seriously. And then you'll ask them what they intend to do about it. And if you cut through all of the rhetoric, it's basically nothing. So, you know, that's the stand of the Bush administration right now.
What about, I guess there's the question of Kyoto and whether by itself it would be enough to stabilize worldwide emissions of greenhouse gases. And I guess another question is whether the U.S.'s refusal to ratify this protocol, whether that could impact the possibilities of reaching a post-Kyoto agreement, because the protocol does expire in 2012, which is just 6 years away. What needs to be said about that?
Well, that is really, really important, and Americans have, unfortunately, a really distorted view of Kyoto from a lot of, you know, propaganda, to be really honest. Kyoto was an agreement that the Americans helped negotiate, and it was based on a protocol. The mechanisms were based on a protocol called the Montreal Protocol, which was the protocol used to phase out ozone-destroying chemicals, and which was very successful, and that was based on the notion that the developed countries go first and the developing countries have a sort of a lag time, and then they also phase out these chemicals. And that more or less has happened, and we were spared, you know, catastrophic ozone loss. So the Kyoto Protocol said the same thing. The developed world goes first in cutting its emissions, and then the developing world will join in. Now, no one ever thought that Kyoto was sufficient to stabilize worldwide emissions. That was never, it's, you know, no one would ever claim that. It certainly isn't true if anyone is claiming it. It was basically an act of good faith. It was basically, it is basically saying, look, we acknowledge a problem and we are moving toward a solution. And the rest of the world has moved forward with Kyoto. Europe, many European countries are on target to actually meet their Kyoto targets. They call for cuts in emissions below 1990 levels, so they're not insignificant. But in a global sense, they do not stabilize emissions because they do not include the developing world, which, as we discussed before, is increasing its emissions very, very rapidly. Now, in terms of moving forward, the fact that the U.S. has not signed on to Kyoto is really quite disastrous because we are the biggest contributors to the problem, so you'd really expect us to take a role in trying to solve the problem, and we've done precisely the reverse. We've refused to participate in solving the problem. So that's bad enough, but it gets worse. If you can believe it, it gets worse. And that is that many countries now, there's actually a provision in the Kyoto Protocol that you've got to start negotiating the successor agreement right now, really like last year, because everyone knows it will be very difficult to negotiate. And when Kyoto lapses in 2012, you want something in place. Otherwise, all the effort that went into Kyoto sort of falls apart. And really, to be honest, the prospects of avoiding disastrous climate change plummet. But what has, who has refused to participate in these negotiations? You guessed it, the U.S. So not only are we not participating in Kyoto, we're preventing these post-Kyoto negotiations from going forward. And without that, without the world sitting at a table and figuring out how we're going to move forward, as I say, preventing the world from crossing these thresholds that we talked about earlier becomes more and more difficult to imagine how we are going to prevent that.
The program is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Co-producer Sasha Lilly is at the controls. I'm C.S. Sung. We have links to resources relating to today's show on our website, againstthegrain.org, where you can also go to download podcasts of our programs. Elizabeth Colbert is our guest. She's author of Field Notes from a Catastrophe, Man, Nature, and Climate Change. She's also a longtime staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. Another place you visited as part of researching and writing this book was the Netherlands, and I think you write that something like a quarter of the Netherlands lies below sea level?
Right.
You're right. What has the government there done as a result in response?
Well, the Netherlands is a really, you know, a country sort of, as we might say, on the front lines of climate change. It's a country built on a river delta, on a lot of reclaimed land. So they are very vulnerable from two sides, as it were. They're vulnerable to increased rainfall and increased floodings on the river, on the Rhine, and they're vulnerable from the sea, from rising sea levels. And those two together can create a real double whammy, because if you get river flooding and if you have higher sea levels, the river water has nowhere to go, so you can get terrible, terrible flooding. And they, one of the things, projects that I, in fact, visited in the Netherlands was in anticipation of both of these effects. The Dutch government is trying to buy up farmland and say that, you know, when there is flooding, basically these lands are just going to, we're just going to let them flood. But it's a really tremendous problem. It's a political problem because, you know, while they're taking steps to try to anticipate this, the land that is needed, the amount of space that is needed, is pretty significant, and you start to run into real resistance. People don't want to give up the places that they've lived, and they don't want to think that they're going to be subject to flooding. So, you know, it's a big political problem.
So you mean the Dutch government is willing at this point to let certain areas go, give it up to the water?
Well, they are letting certain areas go, and they're buying out certain farmers, but then there are other areas, and this goes a little bit beyond what I talk about in the book, but there are other areas of it that they have proposed, saying, look, you know, once every 20, 25 years, These areas are probably going to be flooded, and we're sorry about that. And the people there have kind of gone berserk, as you can imagine. So we don't know what's going to happen to that plan.
Before I ask you about a few of the, I don't know what you'd call them, maybe technological fixes proposed for global warming, including carbon capture and storage, something called space-based solar power, amphibious homes. Mm-hmm. We will only be able to talk about maybe one or two of those things. I do want to ask you about, I mean, you know, a lot of people look at this issue and say, okay, well, there's this problem and there are all these things proposed. And yet the answer really ought to be conservation. It ought to be conservation. Conservation has to be the answer. We have to use less energy. And if we use less energy, there'll be less pollution, et cetera. What's your response to, you know, this drumbeat, which, you know, I totally sympathize with, that people ought to and need to conserve?
I completely sympathize with that. And absolutely that has got to be, if we are going to, and I am one of those people who unfortunately put an if before that, we are going to, you know, get out of this mess. And by getting out, I don't mean, you know, stopping global warming, which is to a certain extent unstoppable. I mean avoiding disaster. Conservation is going to have to play a big role. The complexity that you get into is, you know, in the U.S., there's a tremendous opportunities for conservation because we use so much energy. But is there tremendous opportunities for conservation, you know, in a village in India where they don't use a tremendous amount of energy and where they would like to have refrigerators and air conditioners and all the things that we have? So their energy use, it's very hard to imagine their energy use doing anything but growing. So I think that, you know, what anyone would say, anyone who has really looked at this problem would say is, conservation, you know, is part of the answer, but we also need to shift the way that we produce energy. So it's going to take something of everything. There's no one answer to this, unfortunately.
CCS is carbon capture and storage. How does this work?
Well, it sounds surreal, but apparently, you know, it's getting a lot of consideration now. And what happens is, what you do is you just basically take the CO2 that's being emitted from a large emitter, not you know, from your tailpipe, but from a large emitter like a coal-fired power plant, and you pipe it at very high pressure underground, usually underground or under the sea, into, say, let's say a depleted oil field, and it stays there, and it's what's called a supercritical phase, so it's sort of almost a liquid phase. And the hope is that it will stay there, you know, for a long time, so therefore not be in the atmosphere and therefore not contribute to global warming. And when I first heard about it, I thought, you know, this does sound like sci-fi and wishful thinking. But people, you know, who credible people are beginning to talk about it in a real way. Now, the problem is it adds costs. You can't do it with power plants the way they're built now. You have to build a new generation of power plants. So there's a lot of barriers here. And I think the bottom line is, you know, that unless we take the attitude that we are going to, you know, pay more for our energy, be willing to pay more for energy, it's not going to happen. If you don't penalize, you know, people or make them pay for emitting CO2, there's no reason to capture the CO2 because it costs something. And when other power companies are just emitting it into the air, why would any utility, you know, pay to do something extra?
Right. It requires government mandates, government regulation.
Right, exactly.
And what risks does CCS, carbon capture and storage, pose, if any?
Well, it poses a risk that it doesn't stay down there for a long enough time, you know, and we just don't have long-range records of this because we haven't been doing it. Although people do it, what they do it now for is they just take the CO2, they pump it into to improve oil recovery. You know, they just use it to sort of flush out the oil, but they are not using it. They are not, you know, taking into account how long is that stuff going to stay down there. So one question is simply, how long does it stay there? And I don't think anyone feels that they can answer that question.
One reviewer of Elizabeth Colbert's new book, Field Notes from a Catastrophe, calls it nothing less than a silent spring for our time. And Sylvia Nazar, author of A Beautiful Mind, says of the book, reading Field Notes from a Catastrophe during the 2005 hurricane season is what it must have been like to read Silent Spring 40 years ago. When you put down this book, you'll see the world through different eyes. We have a link to that on our website, againstthegrain.org. Let me see. There's so much else to add. And listeners, if you think we're covering a lot of ground, and we are, there is so much more information in this book that I encourage people to get. Field Notes from a Catastrophe. Elizabeth Colbert is K-O-L-B-E-R-T. You know, we haven't even talked about the risks of extinction of various plant and animal species posed by global warming. This doesn't come up much, but what's the primary threat here?
Well, you know, when you start to think about it, it's sort of intuitively, you know, obvious that many, many organisms, and really on some level virtually all organisms, are climate dependent. Either they eat things that, you know, only emerge under certain climate conditions. They themselves can only exist under certain climate conditions. So you start changing them, and obviously organisms have to respond, and they have basically, you know, three ways of responding. They can move to a place where the climate is suitable, where the climate is like the one they used to know. They can evolve. They can try to it's not a conscious thing, but they can eventually, you know, sort of adapt to the new conditions, or they can go extinct. And one of the really, you know, scary things about what we're doing is that we are changing the climate at a very rapid rate, much more rapidly than would happen under natural circumstances. So all that, although many species have responded to climate change in the past, you know, where I live, you know, it used to be covered in a mile of ice about 20,000 years ago. So, you know, species have adapted, they have moved. We have very good fossil records to show that. We're doing it very fast, so it's really unclear to what extent species are going to be able to get to new habitats or to evolve to, you know, be able to adapt to the changing conditions. And people have done surveys. They're very, very rough because so much is unknown. And they look at what is predicted for the next 50 and 100 years, and they say, you know, anywhere from 10 to 50% of the world's species could be looking at extinction. And that's just a staggering, any of those is a staggering figure.
Yeah, and what's wrong with arguing that, you know, if certain species do find their habitat inhospitable after a certain amount of global warming, that, well, they can just move to a better place?
Well, you know, that's a nice idea. And I certainly hope that many of them do. But when you look at, there's a couple things you have to look at. First of all, many species are at the limit of their range. We are now in a very warm period compared to what most of the last few million years are in. As you and I discussed before, we're already as warm as we've been practically. So if I'm a species that lives near the poles, and I'm sure many people have been hearing about, you know, what's happening to the polar bears, there's nowhere to go. Where are you going to go? You know, you're dependent on the sea ice. Well, there's nowhere to go. So there are those species. There are species that are already, you know, sort of at mountaintops, and they have been pushed there by these warming conditions. So they have nowhere to go. They are very, very vulnerable. But then there's also the fact that we, as humans, even without climate change, are driving many species to the brink of extinction by, you know, ruining their habitat, cutting it up, putting in roads, putting in farms, putting in parking lots, putting in mines. You know, we can go down and down and down the list. So if you don't have that habitat, if the habitat is not accessible to you, if you have to cross, you know, an 8-lane highway to get there, well, your chances of survival don't sound too good.
Just a couple minutes left. A lot of people, when maybe they think about plant species extinction, they think of so-called exotic plants in remote locations. Should we be concerned, should humans be concerned that crop species could become extinct and thereby affect the food supply?
I don't think you have to worry about crop species becoming extinct. I mean, we preserve seed. We're not worried about crop species extinction. What I think that they have to worry about, though, are a couple things. First of all, you know, some of the things, plant species that we harvest, they're not all, you know, there's things like trees. Well, you have a lot of forests that are dying right now because pests that used to be controlled by cold winters, this is especially true in Alaska and up in Canada, are now reproducing at a very rapid rate. These spruce bark beetles are killing millions of acres of trees in Alaska. Okay, so that's one, you know, sort of a harvestable resource that we're really endangering in many parts of the country and many parts of the world. But the other thing that you have to worry about is the crops that you use to grow in certain places. I mean, things like winter wheat, You know, they require certain conditions, and you don't have them anymore. You know, the breadbasket of the U.S. potentially starts to move north, and where does it move north to? Well, it moves north into Canada, potentially, you know, and even leaving aside the question of whether conditions are suitable there, whether the soil is good enough, you know, et cetera, well, it's no longer here. So where, you know, where are we getting our food from?
The book is Field Notes from a Catastrophe, Man, Nature, and Climate Change. Elizabeth Colbert is the author of this acclaimed book. She is a staff writer for The New Yorker. She's been such since 1999, and we thank you very much for joining us to talk about this book. Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot for having me.
And we do have a link to Field Notes from a Catastrophe on againstthegrain.org. And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning. And Sasha and I will look for you next time.
Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Sung. Please visit our companion website, againstthegrain.org, which has instructions for ordering CD copies of programs, links to related resources, and MP3 audio from recent shows, as well as ways of reaching CS and Sasha. And to make a comment or suggestion, drop us an email at againstthegrain@kpfa.org or call us at 510-848-6767, extension 209. Our theme music is by Damal Sound System. Check them out at damalsf.com.